I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us today, a day that we're going to take a deep dive into immigration policy. Green cards, points-based visas, even the coded language of immigration. Right now, President Trump is backing legislation proposed by two Republican senators. It's called
the RAISE Act, R-A-I-S-E. The RAISE Act will reduce poverty, increase wages, and save taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. It will do this by changing the way the United States issues green cards to nationals from other countries.
Now, this is only a proposal that we just heard about yesterday, and the chances that it'll become law are pretty slim. But it's launched a heated conversation. Monica Campbell is our Global Nation editor, and she's been closely following the story. So, Monica, just explain, first of all, this bill to us.
Sure. Well, first, it's called the RAISE Act, and that breaks down as the Reforming American Immigration for a Strong Economy Act. And what Trump is proposing is basically he's going after the green card system, and he wants to slash the number of green cards issued by half. So right now, the U.S. currently issues about 1 million green cards. They want to bring that down to about 500,000 over 10 years. And just, you know, basics here. You get a green card if someone in the U.S., a citizen, say, sponsors you. Usually green cards are for relatives. So if you are from the Philippines or India or Mexico, you can bring in your wife or you can bring in your son. They want to slash that number by half. And they also want to bring in a merit-based system.
So explain the merit-based system and how that'll work.
So that's what's controversial here. It's like a point system. So you get points based on your English skills, your job skills, your education level, your age, and you know, maybe whether you have a high paying job offer in the United States. So it's a really controversial split. They're basically proposing, you know, who's worthy and who isn't worthy to come into the United States. And I thought there was a good tweet about this by the writer Jeff Yang. He wrote, "The poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty doesn't ask for the world's, quote, huddled masses of PhDs yearning to work at Google." Hmm.
So is this reform in the context of immigration reform that so many people have been kind of wanting?
It's not at all comprehensive. The big elephant in the room are the 11 million people already in the United States undocumented. And that was you saw a much more comprehensive bill by the so-called Gang of Eight proposed to address, you know, a lot more people in the United States without papers, the legal immigration system, the whole thing. There was bipartisan support for that bill, and that bill didn't pass. It didn't become law. So this is a much more narrow proposal. It's much more controversial, much more polarizing, and therefore the chances of it actually getting through and made into law are pretty slim.
The World's Monica Campbell helping us make sense of the immigration proposal backed by President Trump. Monica, stick around if you would, please. We've got some other takes on the story, and I want to hear your thoughts. Now, when White House officials presented this immigration plan yesterday, we heard that it had been inspired by the systems in Canada and Australia. Both those countries have merit-based point systems, but it's more complicated than that. Alex Narasta is an immigration policy analyst at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He says the system in Australia has lots of critics.
The big problem with the point system is that the government sets how much each of these points are worth. So if the government thinks that, say, occupations in restaurants are more important than occupations in computer programming, then those types of workers will be favored over workers in computer programming. The problem with this is, of course, the government doesn't know which industries necessarily are the ones that demand these workers, that require these workers, where these workers would be best. So this is essentially just government planning of the types of occupations that they think are going to grow in the future. And as a result of that, there's a lot of lobbying, there's a lot of crony capitalism, there's a lot of problems.
I mean, I was kind of surprised that Canada uses this merit-based system because it's got such a reputation for being open to immigration from many different places around the world. How does this work in Canada?
What's interesting is in all this discussion, the Canadian system, people leave out three facts that are important. One, Canada allows private sponsorship of refugees, which means that the refugee flow to Canada as a percentage of their population is far greater than it is in the United States. The second factor is that the family flows to Canada are actually tremendous. They're very large. So in that way, the Canadian system is more friendly to families than the American system is. And then the last point is that Canada allows provinces to invite immigrant workers or entrepreneurs on top of the federal cap. So as a result of this, all of these flows together add up to an immigration system that is very generous compared to the United States. So for instance, about 21% of Canada's population is foreign born. In the United States, it's only about 13.5%.
Are there cases that you could point to in either Australia or Canada that have illustrated the failures or the successes of either system?
So it's a stereotype in both of these countries that you have immigrants with master's degrees or PhDs who are driving taxi cabs or doing lots of other low-wage work because the skills that they have are not well-suited to the Canadian or Australian markets. So as a result, the point system could emphasize a PhD in a subject for which there just is no labor market demand in these countries.
There are very educated people in the United States driving cabs, former ministers of information from, you know, name the country.
There are always exceptions to every rule, but the general trend when you look at the statistics is that highly skilled immigrants in the United States do better relative to other Americans, relative to other skilled workers here, than highly skilled immigrants in Canada and Australia do relative to their populations, just because the U.S. system is better at matching the skills actually demanded by our economy with the skills that the immigrants have.
That's Alex Narasta with the Cato Institute. Monica Campbell, our Global Nation editor, you heard a lot of libertarian points in there. The free market is better than the government at choosing workers. What did you think of what Alex Narasta was saying?
I agree with a lot of what he said, but I also, it just continually strikes me that it seems like we're talking about immigrants as workers. And I think, you know, the saying goes that we wanted workers and we got families. And I think it's, this is like a very limited way of looking at immigrants and how the U.S. is connected to people from all over the world. It sort of disregards the upside of families coming together in the U.S., you know, the ability of a family-based, you know, sponsorship, people able to reunite. And the question is, you know, should who is allowed to come into the U.S. or not come into the U.S. come down to a job offer? And is the U.S. government the best way to go about predicting, you know, how dynamic our economy is and who should be let in, who should not be let in, and where they should be working and where the demand is for the workers?
Monica Dunko, we're going to check back in with you one more time after we talk about the English language slice of this bill. Maybe you've heard that exchange between CNN reporter Jim Acosta and White House advisor Stephen Miller yesterday about the proposed changes to immigration policy. Here's Acosta asking whether a skills-based approach granting green cards is in line with U.S. tradition.
The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. Aren't you trying to change what it means to be an immigrant coming into this country if you're telling them you have to speak English? Can't people learn how to speak English when they get here?
Well, first of all, right now, it's a requirement that to be naturalized, you have to speak English. So the notion that speaking English wouldn't be a part of our immigration systems would be actually very ahistorical.
Well, not quite. It's true that the naturalization exam requires a test in English. But for immigrants who don't speak English fluently, there can be an exemption. The U.S. doesn't have an official language, but many people think English should be it. Rosalie Porter is on the board of directors for the organization Pro English. I mean, it's a small part of the bill, but it's a really important part, and it strikes a lot of emotions. I mean, you came to the U.S. at the age of 6, didn't know any English yourself. I mean, isn't it part of the American ideology that people should be allowed to do that? And we're not talking citizenship. We're just talking about coming into the country for a green card.
Well, if they're coming into the country with a green card, that implies they are going to stay, they are going to work. And without immigrants knowing some English or being ready to acquire the language, we have problems, and they are very, very expensive. The executive order that President Clinton signed that requires all sorts of organizations, and especially hospitals and doctor's offices, to provide translation services for anyone that requires them. The fact is, there are 329 languages spoken in this country today. This is a hugely expensive requirement that has cost the economy a great deal of money in the past 20 years.
Do you believe, though, that all these translation services actually have cost us more than what we've received in economic benefits from people who've come to this country and may not speak English?
Well, you're saying immigration services cost us more
than we have
received in economic benefits. That may be true.
I'm saying that we get more economic.
I'm an expert on language and the situation of immigrant children and their families. That's my area.
Your point of view, Rosalie, does it see an America that is less connected to the rest of the world?
Good heavens, how could we be more connected when we receive over 1 million immigrants every year? We are the most diverse country on the face of the earth. Where is any other country doing more to accommodate immigrants with education, with health care?
And with all those numbers being brought down by the Trump administration, you still believe that?
Look, nobody today is recommending that we stop immigration. But only in the past 40 years, our population in the United States has doubled, and 60% of that increase is from immigration. Maybe we should look at reducing the level of immigration. Let the bill come before Congress and let it be discussed in open forum. Let's see what they decide.
Rosalie Porter there with the organization Pro English. Monica Campbell still with us. Quickly, Monica, your reaction?
It's always interesting to hear that we are an incredibly diverse country, but that perhaps we've reached this limit. We've heard this before, and again, we're hearing it now. But there are really big parts of the country that are going the other way. California overturned its ban on bilingual education, and there are no studies out there that show English-speaking immigrants are more likely to benefit the U.S. economy. So what we're seeing is the Trump administration pushing back pretty drastically on this right now.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much for walking us through all this, Monica.
You're welcome.
The immigration bill that we've been talking about a lot today, there's one group that wouldn't be affected by it, so-called guest workers, people who come into the country for seasonal work. By some estimates, more than 1 million people get visas for these programs each year. For more on this, we checked in with Jennifer Hunt. She served in the Labor Department under President Obama. So I asked her for a quick overview of these seasonal work programs.
Well, for seasonal workers, there are two main programs, the agricultural and the non-agricultural seasonal worker program. So the agricultural program is called the H-2A, and the non-agricultural is the H-2B.
Yeah. Give me a couple of examples of seasonal work that would qualify for either of these visas.
Just generally things to do with tourism, actually, in both cases, the winter and summer. So working at the beach in various capacities, working at ski resorts in various capacities. So it could be ski instructor or working in the bar or whatever.
And then you've got H-1B visas and O visas. Just briefly talk about those as well.
Yeah, so those are different in that although they are temporary visas, they're a lot less temporary than the other ones. So the H-1B, for example, which among the temporary visas is one of the larger ones, you initially get it. You get the visa for 3 years and it can be renewed once. And I'm actually glad that you mentioned the O-1 because some people think that the most skilled workers are admitted into the H-1B, but actually that's the O-1 visa where you have to submit documents and so forth, establishing that you've already accomplished abroad quite a bit in your field. H-1Bs, I don't want to call them that unskilled, they're certainly not unskilled, but some of them are perhaps more like fairly skilled rather than extremely skilled workers. So, for example, computer programmers.
Trump has said that foreign workers are taking jobs away from U.S. citizens and hurting Americans. But then last month, his administration announced it would raise the visa cap for low-wage seasonal workers by 15,000. Isn't there a contradiction there?
There is a contradiction. So I'm not going to try and explain the contradiction. However, the thing that's incorrect is to think that immigration actually does hurt the U.S. economy. So I was a member of this National Academies panel that brought out a report in September on the economic impact of immigration, and it comprised the top economists and demographers who work on immigration and spanned a range of views. And in our consensus report, we do say that immigration helps not only increase the overall size of the economy, but also the part of the pie that's going to the native born. And so the controversy about immigration should be only about how that increased pie is being distributed amongst natives. So is it all going to firms? Is anyone actually losing? So in general, there are actually winners and losers from immigration, even as it increases the size of the pie available for natives. So although our report actually had a consensus that average wages are not affected by immigration in the U.S., we did agree that high school dropout natives were hurt by immigration.
So Trump is also being criticized for bringing in seasonal workers to his resorts. I know Stephen Miller responded to that, saying the bill isn't about seasonal workers, but people are still seeing, still conflating this and seeing hypocrisy. Is that fair?
Well, if President Trump thinks that his job is to protect American workers, and yet his own businesses, he does something which he believes hurts American workers, there's obviously a contradiction there. It seems hypocritical to me to be opposed to bringing in immigrants in general and unskilled immigrants in particular, and then to be hiring them in your own company. That does seem hypocritical to me.
Jennifer Hunt, professor of economics at Rutgers, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.